From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Fred Upton and Alyssa Slotkin talk about the long-delayed COVID stimulus package and growing support for moderate ideas in Congress.
What I hope people appreciate is when you're independently minded and when you're practical. When you actually help get something done for people's pocketbooks and kids.
Also, 50-year news radio veteran Dick Hafner talks about going the distance.
One of my watchword slogans to myself was, if you can't run fastest, try to run farthest. And maybe I did that.
And May Erlewine drops a surprise holiday record with hopeful renditions of classic songs.
My vocal interpretation was not really intentionally happy, but I really just wanted it to be very calming and peaceful and easy to listen to.
Hallelujah! Those stories just ahead. From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the program, we talk with Dick Hafner, who's wrapping up more than 50 years in news radio in Detroit. That's later in the show. But first, congressional leaders say they're close to a deal on a COVID relief package. That's especially important before they break for the holidays. Some unemployment benefits are expiring with the new year. This will leave millions of Americans stranded during a particularly difficult time in American history. In both the U.S. Senate and the House, there are bipartisan work groups trying to come up with workable solutions. In the House, this group is the so-called Problem Solvers Caucus. And two of those members are Michigan representatives. We're speaking today with Fred Upton, Republican, and Alyssa Slotkin, Democrat, and they join us now. Fred, Alyssa, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Can I ask you to summarize the sticking points for lawmakers on both sides of the aisle? Fred, would you like to start us off?
Well, we're very close. I've been part of a smaller group within the Problem Solvers, a bipartisan sort of working group we call the Tiger Team, working with our Senate colleagues and putting together a package. Frankly, we've been working since July on this. They keep moving the goalposts on us, but now it's really got to happen, and we're very close. Just a couple of I's and a couple of T's that need to be dotted and crossed. But in essence, it'll be about $908 billion. It'll involve more money for small businesses through the PPP program. It'll help give the states more money for unemployment insurance, up to $300 a week for folks, and not the $600 that we had, last March, but obviously a welcome sign. Individual stimulus checks for individuals, up to probably about $600. We're going to change the income threshold a little bit for eligibility to make sure that all the dollars meet. More money for broadband, obviously more money for testing. And for helping the states actually distribute the vaccines now that they've been approved, and also for health care for our hospitals as well as our educators. So in a nutshell, those are the major components. $908 billion, we're almost there. We really are. And hopefully this comes to be probably Saturday afternoon, maybe in the House, and probably Sunday or so in the Senate.
Alyssa Slotkin, could you run over some of the sticking points and maybe which of them are still in the bill and which of them are out?
Sure. Well, in a negotiation of $900 billion, no one's going to get every single thing that they want. That's the nature of compromise, particularly in divided government. And that is our job as legislators, is to get something done before Christmas. So with that as our mandate, there's some things that didn't make it in that I know on the Democratic side of the aisle, we were particularly focused on money for state and local governments, right? To help make up the lost revenues due to COVID, not old debts, not pensions, but lost revenues. I will continue to fight for that because I am worried about pink slips for our police, our fire, our first responders, our teachers in 2021. That did not make it in. We did not see some of the liability, the limits to liability that some of our businesses and our Republican senators in particular wanted. That could not be negotiated. We couldn't come to agreement on that. So it's not in. And then, of course, there's always a conversation about kind of what is the right amount, the Goldilocks approach, things like on unemployment, right? There's lots of business owners who have lots of different views that $600 per check was a lot. There are people who feel like it's extremely important that we have a lot of money in those unemployment checks every week. So we settled on $300. But the state and local money and the limiting of liability were sort of the big ticket ones that just could not be hammered out. And we can't wait on that, right? We've got an urgent need now.
Well, to that end, I would like to play for you two something that one of our recent guests said. This is a fellow named Mike Wells, who's the owner of Blackfire Winery in Tecumseh. I should be clear, he doesn't live in either of your districts, but he certainly represents what a lot of Michigan business owners and employees are feeling right now. He was very frustrated as he was seeking to apply for a Michigan Economic Development Corporation grant. Let's listen to what he told us.
When I got online, it started at 9 o'clock, and it took me a little bit to get into the site. And there was 10,088 people in line in front of me. And I chose not to close that link. And I did not actually do my application until 7:28 that night. And it's a first come, first serve basis. They've divided the money up by regions. And I guess in that time of while I was waiting and doing other things, I was thinking, you know, it was the state of Michigan that shut everybody down. Once I just added up how many breweries, how many wineries, and how many restaurants there are in the state, that's over 17,000 businesses in itself. And I feel like the state is offering us crumbs to run and go grab. And I don't think it's fair. And I don't think it's fair that the state, since they've put us in this position, they're not stepping up to remedy it for everyone.
Now, just to be clear, Mike Wells was thinking about this in terms of state level COVID-related health restrictions. But as I know you're both aware, it would be the federal government's position to offer the kind of massive help to businesses and employees that would have helped him in his difficulties. What do you have to say to people who are angry about this taking so long?
Well, let me just say that we hear his pain. It is a tough time for everyone. There's no question about that. And though neither Alyssa nor I really have much to say about state-managed or state-run programs, I know why they're there, and let's hope that they iron out these wrinkles real quick. As it relates to the federal side of things, it was almost the same with the PPP program. Remember, this is Paycheck Protection. This was normally administered by the Small Business Administration, a federal agency, but when it came to be, and it was literally at the end of the day, it could be pretty close to maybe $800-900, maybe even $1 trillion to help our small businesses. Many of them had the same glitches that this man from Tecumseh was experiencing as well. A new program, no one knew exactly how to get it done, or took long time to get the money. We all stepped in. I mean, I worked directly with our Michigan bankers, with our community bankers, with our credit unions and others to help manage the program that really provided tens of thousands of dollars, even millions of dollars, to some of our small businesses so that they could, in fact, they would have a place to come back to, those folks, when that business reopened up again. And it's not going to be over, early next year until this vaccine really gets out there, which is why we need another round of PPP. And one of the things that we're doing in this legislation that we hope to vote on Saturday is to make sure that those grants then are tax-free. So we make these PPP loans, as they should have been, as the intent was, tax-free as well. So for the guy in Tecumseh, we feel your pain. In the state's defense, it's a new program. Let's hope those glitches get ironed out, just as we hope that the glitches with the PPP, working with our local banks on the federal side, are worked out in this next round as well.
Alyssa Slotkin, we're hearing rumblings that the new relief package will not include money for cities and states to put toward their budget deficits. What can you tell us about why that issue was tabled? We know it was important for Democrats.
Yeah, this is what I was referring to before. That's sort of my biggest disappointment. We heard from so many of our mayors and our firefighters, our police forces, just the importance of getting money to cover lost revenues. And I'll be honest, we have an ideological difference with some of our colleagues in the Senate on whether the federal government should be providing that kind of aid. And frankly, in normal times, I don't support that kind of thing. But these are not normal times. And in the end, it became kind of this roadblock, the state and local money, and then the limiting of liability. We tried to trade, frankly. We tried to negotiate and give a little and get a little, but it was just holding up the entire package. And you had to take a moment. And I've been involved in negotiations. You have to make a call at a certain point that are you going to let the perfect be the enemy of the good? And on this, when it's about people losing their unemployment or losing ability to go to a food bank, I mean, we had an urgency there. So it fell out because we could not get to a place where Democrats and Republicans could agree on these two important issues. But we're going to go back at it in January. Don't you worry.
Well, I was just going to concur with Alyssa. I was one that wanted both. I thought that we had a good language for both, not only for liability protections from gross negligence for small businesses that was limited in terms of time. But also, you know, I know as I reached out to a lot of my Michigan folks as it related to funding for state and local, you know, the state of Michigan, we may have a budget hole of maybe as much as $1 billion or $1.5 billion. That's awfully tough. I thought it was a fair deal that we had, and we just couldn't get the senators to come to an agreement. I know that we could have had the votes in the House, but we just couldn't get the votes done in the Senate. And at the end, to get it done by a deadline, knowing that with a new Congress, with a new administration, it will be months before we see another package emerge. We just couldn't wait beyond Christmas to get this thing done, knowing that we've been working so hard really since last summer to try and get this next COVID package done.
Assuming that Congress does revisit COVID relief after the first of the year, should Americans expect another stimulus check and or compensation for their dependent children?
Well, I think it'll depend upon where the economy is. As I said, it'll be a new Congress. You got a new administration that's coming in on January 20th. It'll take a little while for them to get, you know, all their people in place. So you're talking months down the road. So where will the economy be? Do we have four vaccines that are approved? We've got one today with Pfizer. Great news, obviously, coming out of Michigan. Moderna will probably be later this week. AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson early next year. Where are we in terms of vaccinating Americans? Where are we in terms of the economy? You know, it'll be the snapshot of where we are in late February or March when the next COVID package would likely begin to move if, in fact, there are still real trouble signs that are out there.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk to Representatives Slotkin and Upton about the seemingly vanishing breed of center-leading lawmakers. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're talking today with State Representatives Alyssa Slotkin and Fred Upton. They are, respectively, a Democrat and a Republican, and part of the bipartisan work group known as the Problem Solvers Caucus. You two are both fairly moderate, center-leaning lawmakers, and your constituents have rewarded you for that with re-election. In Fred's case, many, many times. Fred, right now, you're the only Michigan Republican in Congress who did not sign on to the Texas lawsuit against our state's election results. Paul Mitchell recently left the party, and Justin Amash left the GOP last year. I want to ask both of you if you think moderate politicians can hold on through this particularly partisan time in our history. Alyssa, could you start out? I know that there are a lot of questions within the Democratic Party, too, about whether the way forward is leaning into progressive ideals or reaching across the aisle.
Yeah, you know, I think certainly on the Democratic side, we have a big tent. And what goes on in places like New York is not what people are asking of me in Lansing and in Holly, Michigan. For me, I think what I hope people appreciate is when you're independently minded and when you're practical, when you actually help get something done for people's pocketbooks and kids. And for me, that's what people expect of me in my district. And I feel very passionately about things. But at the end of the day, the job is to legislate and to help people with constituent services. It's not just to have big thoughts that you put out into the internet, it's to actually get something done. That is the school that I come from as a CIA officer and a former Pentagon official. But it's also, I think, what my district asks of me every single day. And I do think that if you just look at the raw numbers, certainly on the Democratic side of the House, the vast majority of us are practical, reasonable people. They may not get all the media attention, but that represents the majority. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the majority in the U.S. House right now. So the most important thing is we've got to have a clear picture of what we want economically and what we're going to help people with in this next Congress. That's our job and our mandate.
Fred Upton, how do you think about growing the center, maybe especially among some of the incoming Republican class?
Well, you know, the Problem Solvers Caucus, and I'm one of the vice chairs on the Republican side, we've been a very valuable ally to really get things done. You take this COVID issue. Again, it was our group that was called into the Situation Room to meet with then. It was the first day on the job for Deborah Birx. What could we do? We talk about masks. We talk about assistance. We talked about Operation Warp Speed. And such exciting news for us in Michigan to see what happened with Pfizer right there in Portage, Michigan, in Kalamazoo County. Actually rolling the trucks out this last week. So, you know, as I look at things, and man, we have some detractors. You know, I praised on I don't know, Facebook or Twitter, you know, what was happening with Pfizer, and wouldn't believe some of the hate mail that came my way. You got some people that are never going to be satisfied with anything. But you know what? The country, you know, as I look at the Problem Solvers Caucus, we're roughly, you know, 50 members in this Congress. We're going to be more in the next Congress. So we had a Zoom call yesterday. We do meet every week. We're going to be expanding our numbers in the next Congress. We've got Republicans and Democrats, some current members, some new members that want to join our force. And with divided government, it's going to be close in the House. It's close in the Senate. You know, a new administration, it'll be our group that's going to be called to really govern and try to make some sense out of this place. Not a partisan Republican or a partisan Democratic side, but, you know, taking the best ideas of both, which is frankly what this COVID package is in terms of what we're trying to get done.
Fred Upton represents Michigan's 6th Congressional District. He's a Republican. We've also been talking with Alyssa Slotkin, Democrat, who represents Michigan's 8th. Fred, Alyssa, great talking to you. Stay safe through the holidays.
You bet. Wear your mask.
Bye, guys. Thank you.
Earlier in the year, we had a lovely conversation with the talented singer-songwriter May Erlewine, who, like the rest of Michigan's musical community, is dealing with prohibitions on live shows, not being able to gather in groups with other musicians. She's already put out one well-reviewed album this year, but May is never one to shirk from a challenge. She surprised her fans with a brand new holiday album this month, entitled A Simple Phrase, that includes her takes on some classics. And she joins us now. May Erlewine, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
Boy, the last time we spoke, there were still leaves on the trees and it was nice and warm. How are things going? What have things been like for you since then?
Wow, yeah. I remember I talked to you and then went for like a kayak out on the lake. And so, yeah, different realm now with the snow on the ground. I'm hanging in there, you know. It's a wild, wild time, and everybody's sort of making the best of it. And I feel grateful to have the support I have, but I'm just kind of hunkered down at home. Don't see very many humans, and just kind of waiting this thing out.
Do you find yourself feeling more isolated since the weather turned?
You know, it's been such a weird season shift that it's just starting to feel like the snow is here and winter is upon us. So I haven't totally gotten that like deep winter blues thing yet, but I've been bracing myself for it. So I feel okay so far. So far, so good.
Yeah. This moment can be a curse or a blessing for artists, depending on their situation. You've been so busy. As we mentioned, we had in May a release from you, the harmony-laden The Dreams That Hold This Child, with your vocal group, the Sweetwater Warblers. That's you and Rachel Davis and Lindsay Liu and Mae DeVitri. And then in August, when we talked to you, you just dropped this jazzy, soulful release that you made with the Woody Goss Band called Anyway. And now this new record. Let's take a little listen to one of the tracks.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now will be out of sight.
Why did you want to drop a holiday album this year?
Well, you know, to be totally honest, I would never have planned on doing that. I've kind of always thought, oh, I don't think I'll ever make a holiday record that's actually holiday Christmas songs. But my friend and manager, every meeting we had for months, at the beginning of the meeting, she would be like, so how are you feeling about making a holiday record? And she just was very persuasive and just like continuing to invite the idea. So I kept thinking about it. And I said, I'm just trying to get my mind around if I can do it authentically. And then I was doing a live show and I asked those that were listening, hey, if I put out some music for this holiday season, would you rather it be like, you know, Christmas music covers or like some other material that I come up with? And everybody just freaked out about the idea of a holiday record. Like it was almost unanimous, like 300 people were just like commenting and asking. And so I was like, wow, people just really want this. And I like holiday music. I'm not one of those people who can't, you know, handle listening to it. And so I thought, well, you know, I think I'll just make a really mellow kind of comforting blanket of holiday tunes that I love that are, you know, more like secular stuff and see how it goes. And so I borrowed a classical guitar and kind of went after it in my house by myself. And it was a really sweet process, actually. I enjoyed it very much.
I wanted to ask you a bit about your orientation to holiday music. I mean, what kind of stuff was on in your house when you were a kid?
When I was growing up, the main Christmas record that I remember was, well, there was two. There was Vince Guaraldi's. The other one was Phil Spector's Christmas, which is like all these sort of like groovy soul Christmas songs by the LA peeps. And that album I still listen to every Christmas. It's so good. It's just like really fun. And so those two were the main ones, I think.
At the same time, your own musical style is more folk influenced, a little more of the American primitive edging on the sound. Why did you, I mean, there is the practical matter of just being able to record yourself, but what kind of vibe and what kind of treatment did you think you wanted to lay on these songs?
Well, there was the reality of just not being able to go in the studio simply and safely. And when I thought about Christmas music in general, there's a lot of like super big band upbeat, like fully fleshed out, like produced songs. That's like kind of a lot of what you can grab if you grab Christmas record, the bells and the, you know, just the whole thing. And so I realized that I often reach for some of the more stripped down ones that are like just the guitar instrumental. Like I love, my friend Lyle Brewer has a beautiful Christmas record called Silver Bells, and it's just him playing guitar. John Fahey has one too. And so those are the ones I really love because you put them on and you get to chill, and they're sort of like the background of your gathering or your celebrating or, you know, whatever, your Christmas present wrapping. And so I thought, you know, I want to do that, but also with singing. And I sort of modeled a lot of the sounds after one of my favorite records. It's the Getz Gilberto. It's just like a lot of like kind of reverb and very stripped down. And it's like the voice is very, very present. The guitar is very warm and almost a little like boomy. And it's just like, so we kind of like created, we listened to that as a reference for the tracks and the piano sounds. And obviously I'm not either of those people, but we use that as a reference for just those stripped down, beautiful sounds.
How did you pick the songs?
It was hard. I spent like a month just trying to pick the songs. And I picked them. I made a list of ones that I love that didn't have a strong like religious leaning. And they were more just about the holiday and being together. And so I knew I wanted to lean that way, especially if I was doing actual Christmas songs, which I'd never done. And so I just started going through and making a list. And there are some that just kind of pulled on my heartstrings. And then after I made the list and kind of narrowed down the ones like that I had an achy feeling about, like, oh, I love that one. Like, I just love that song. Then I tried to play them all and just kind of felt out how they would feel being sung in a solo, just instrument voice situation. And so I kind of picked the ones that I felt like would work well for what I was planning to do. And then just, you know, came down to those that I picked. And then I added one that isn't a Christmas song at all, but that I thought would be nice for the times that we're in.
Yeah. You know, looking at the tracks on this, you have, you know, perfectly cheerful songs like Silver Bells on here, but also you included some of what I would consider the Christmas weepers. There's I'll Be Home for Christmas, which is so full of longing.
I'll be home for Christmas. You can plan on me. Please have snow and mistletoe and presents on the tree.
The one that just brings me to my knees every time, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. But I have to say, your treatment on all of these is so hopeful. Was that something that you were thinking about as you were doing the vocal interpretations on these?
I feel like these, a lot of them are more of the, like, yeah, like longing sort of not as simple Christmas songs as far as the sentiments, which is probably why I'm drawn to them being a songwriter. And my vocal interpretation was not really intentionally happy, but I really just wanted it to be very calming and peaceful and easy to listen to. Like, that was my whole goal with the whole thing, is like everybody's anxiety is so high during this season in general, especially this year. And so I really wanted to just provide some really consistent, calm energy. And so that's the space I went to when I was singing these songs. And I also slowed them way down. So, like, they're all just, like, extremely chill. And so that was kind of what I was reaching for with the vocal. And it was a nice space to be in for me, too.
Have you had some difficult moments this holiday season? It's obviously a time to count blessings and, you know, do some things that are fun. But seasonal holiday blues is a real thing. And I know a lot of people are really feeling it this year.
Yeah. In 2012, I lost my best friend. His birthday's today. And he passed away 2 days after his birthday. And I went to his funeral over the holiday. And ever since then, I just really was shifted into understanding, like, how different the holidays feel when you have a significant event like that in your life, whether it be around the holidays or not. It's like, if people are experiencing any sort of grief or loss, or family dynamics, then the holidays are just this kind of, you know, almost raise the volume of those things that are sometimes troubling, because it puts a lot of pressure on everything. And so I noticed that after losing my friend and going through my divorce, like, when you're living a sort of non-traditional life that doesn't fit into the holiday picture, then the holidays all of a sudden can become like this trigger or a lot of pressure. And so that's when I started doing the Motivations dance parties, was for that reason. So it's something I've been thinking about for a while now. And then knowing just everybody is at capacity with their sort of being stretched emotionally right now with the pandemic and political climate we've been in. So I feel like it's very real. And for me, it's sort of always a little bit of a process getting through December. But since I have my beautiful daughter and she has so much joy with this season, I feel grateful to be able to lean into that with her and kind of create the Christmas magic. And so it's both, you know, for me.
Yeah. You know, we're still in this limbo where there are not live shows, or if there are, they're outside and everybody's very muffled and maybe standing next to something that's burning. And there is no tour right now. And that's obviously such a huge hit to all artists. I just kind of wondered what your hopes are for 2021, what your expectations are, and what you're planning for. I mean, are you thinking you might be able to do shows and festivals this summer?
You know, it's so hard to say, and people are planning and trying to book stuff. I just decided to wait. And so I'm sort of a wait and see person. And so we're not booking things right now. And I'm just going to see what happens. And when it feels really safe for me to do that, like, I don't really want to play shows unless I really feel like it's safe for people to be present, knowing that not everybody is as precautious with their social distancing. So I just feel a lot of responsibility and haven't done anything this whole time. And so I just want to wait till it really feels like it's okay. And so I'm just waiting and going to continue my live shows. I have Patreon that is I'm very active with and is very supportive. I'm making more music. And this winter, I'm hoping to launch a songwriting course online for people to participate in. So just kind of trying to stay busy in the ways that feel safe right now. And then we'll see if and when it's safe this summer to do some live shows, then I will.
Here's hoping.
Yeah.
May Erlewine's new holiday album is called A Simple Phrase. May, it's so good to hear from you. Thank you so much.
You too. Thanks so much.
Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up on the show, a 50-year veteran of the radio broadcast news business talks to us about his years in the job and his most difficult stories to cover. WJR's Dick Hafner will be with us in a moment. Stay tuned. This is Stateside. I'm April Bear. 2020 has been such a crazy year. You might have missed a big centennial. It's been 100 years since Detroit radio station WWJ became the first commercial broadcast station in the United States. And in those 100 years of radio, our next guest spent the last 5 decades reporting on Michigan news for numerous stations and news services. Dick Hafner just retired after spending the last 30 years at WJR in Detroit, and it is our pleasure. Dick, welcome to Stateside.
Wow, I'm so delighted to be here. Thank you for the opportunity. It's my honor. I'm your biggest fan, so now I get to be on your show. This is a big thrill for me.
It's a mutual admiration society, for sure. First off, congratulations on your retirement after 50-plus years of being in the news industry. You know, it's so rare for people to stay in the business that long these days. I feel like you sort of did the Iron Man achievement.
Well, yeah, it's kind of astounding for me when I look at that in hard black and white 51 years of doing this nonstop, and no one kicked me out of the room. No one opened the door and told me it's time to exit. So I'm pretty astounded that I lasted so long myself. I do have to tell you that I never considered myself the best newscaster or the best reporter or the best news director. I thought I had some talents in those areas. But I always thought that going back a long way, one of my watchword slogans to myself was, if you can't run fastest, try to run farthest. And maybe I did that.
Again, with the Ironman ultra marathon analogy, you grew up in a time when TV and radio were still sort of in competition with each other for media dominance.
Yes.
Was there something that drew you to radio in particular?
As a child, my favorite thing that I had, my favorite possession, my most prized possession was my transistor radio. As a child, I got a radio and started listening to it and was fascinated by the voices and the things I heard, entertainment, music, but especially news. I was drawn to the newscasts on the radio as a child. During the daytime, I could, if I wasn't in school or out playing baseball or football, that's really what I wanted to do, I could listen to the local news. And at night, I was one of those kids who turned the dial to listen to what was happening in those faraway places. I discovered that you could travel by way of your little radio on these scratchy AM radio stations. So I could take a trip to exotic, exciting places like Pittsburgh or St. Louis or even Toronto. And I was thrilled. I like to do it even now. I love to fiddle around with my shortwave radio and listen in to the radio stations of the world. So that's how I got interested in this. And I thought it was much more exciting and interesting than television, where you're tied to a picture and they're programming and talking around the picture in radio. It's so much simpler and direct. You have to concentrate on the spoken word or you're going to miss what's happening. Nothing else is helping you. There's no visual assistance to you. You have to listen carefully. And to me, that is the power of radio.
A man after my own heart. When did your career officially begin? I read that you and a friend basically started the newsroom at Wayne State's public radio station, WDET. Was that the start of it all?
Well, we didn't realize it at the time, but yes. We, being myself and my friend Dave Robinson, who had just gotten back from Vietnam as a Marine and was a 26-year-old Wayne State student. I was 19. And we were on the little campus radio station doing news when the Wayne State public station decided that they would expand from just playing classical music all day and night and start doing some news. So they incorporated us from the little campus station, brought us in, and in the fall of 69, I had my chance to be on the airwaves for the first time in Detroit, doing newscast for free. I was happy to be doing that. I thought they were doing me a great favor, which they were. And later on, like all you public broadcasters, you find some magical way to get a few bucks connected with what you're doing. And so we did that. But that was my first exposure on the air. And at the time, we didn't know it, but we were creating this little news department, which is still in business today and doing very well.
Yeah. Was it a big shock when you ultimately moved over to commercial radio?
Yes, it was a big shock when I had to realize very early on that our mission was twofold. One, to put good programming on the air, but two, just as important, maybe more important, we had to make money. We had to make a profit for our company. So coming out of a college environment, which I was still in when I got my first commercial job, yes, I had to learn that very quickly.
Dick, you've been around for so many really important moments and changes in Michigan's history and in Detroit's history. What are some of the biggest changes that you've noticed, and what do you think has remained the same?
The auto industry, of course, is diminished, but is changing, evolving. The threatened Great Lakes, something that should disturb and concern all of us in Michigan and all the surrounding states. I thought that in recent years, the legalization of marijuana was a major step, Michigan. Because I grew up in the era of nasty Mary Jane.
And reefer madness, yeah.
And reefer madness. Of course, one of my favorite bands are the Coral Reefers of Jimmy Buffett, but that's a side issue. But in Detroit, and of course, my reporting and experience is mainly Detroit-centric, I'm impacted every day. When I go into the city and go to work and drive around and look around and see all the empty spaces, and you see that in Flint also, and in a couple of our auto-oriented cities where there are large vacant spaces where there used to be lots of people and buildings and houses. So those are the changes I've seen, but that's the reality of how life changes. And I understand that even if I feel that some of those changes are bad and have been bad, we can make it good for ourselves if we do it right.
Dick, I've heard a couple of different interpretations of how history works, American history works. You know, some people see it as more of a timeline where this happens and then that happens and then something else happens, and there's some sort of sense of moving forward through time. And more recently, I've heard people talk about history as more of a pendulum that swings back and forth, and certain things repeat themselves over time. Which theory do you think is more true?
I'm the pendulum person, definitely. Politically speaking, we always see the struggle between not only the political parties, but what people are thinking, and they all seem to repeat themselves to me. Also, on the subject of how we in the news business cover breaking news, even though our technology has changed so much, has changed the way we try to cover the breaking news, the rules stay the same. And the concerns I have always heard from reporters stay the same as they were 51 years ago when I started. I'm a newsman who likes to cover history as it's happening, and that's what I do best. As far as highfalutin philosophical conversations, I leave it to people who are a lot smarter than I am.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Dick Hafner, longtime Detroit newsman. He's just wrapped up a 50-year career, including the past 30 years at station WJR. Dick, you're of an age to have covered not just one or two, but several frightening periods of history. You know, you were working in the period in which 9/11 happened, when history and world events got a lot real and a lot more vivid to a lot of people, even in the Great Lakes region, who didn't consider themselves great consumers of this. You were around and of working age during the uprising. You know, one of several points at which a lot of people in Michigan realized that many things they might have assumed about their state were not necessarily true. What were some of the hardest stories that you had to cover?
Now, in 1967, I was 17. I only took my car as close to the conflagration as I could get so that I could see it as a citizen. I was already interested in news, and I kind of thought that's where I was going, and I needed to see it for myself. And fortunately for me, when I got too close, some of the African-American people that I encountered looked at this suburban white kid, and they warned me, don't go any farther. Go back. And so I did. So I only covered the aftermath of the what I call conflagration. And it's been certainly interesting, sometimes difficult, to see all the steps and the developments that have occurred in response to that. Those were difficult times. And I'm talking about the early 70s now, when I first encountered people like Coleman Young, the young Ken Cockrell, the mayors of Detroit, some of the terrific city council people that we had, and some of the bad ones, and community activists. I was lucky enough to meet and talk with many of those people, but also had to keep my head down sometimes because I would be in the middle of actual trouble going on. And then I also got to see things like plane crashes, and what happened to families who were affected by people who died in those plane crashes or other big tragedies that occurred. And later on, we had to certainly deal with the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. They didn't happen here, but they affected everyone here. And I got to listen to some of the stories of people, families of those who died in the crashes. Certainly there was a big Detroit connection with some of the offices that were in the Twin Towers and have local connections. Mm-hmm. Those were stories that always have stuck with me. Very interesting to go back and read and listen to some of the things that we did and some of the things I did. And always think of another question that I should have asked, or something else that I should have been curious about, but wasn't. I know you go through the same thing sometimes when you go through your archives or your old tapes.
Absolutely. Was there ever a time or a story that made you feel like you were at a loss for words? And if so, what would you do?
When I was involved in doing reports over the years about what was called the Oakland County Child Killer, a series of abductions and murders that occurred in the 1970s in Oakland County. I was heavily involved in that. And so I would encounter the families of the children who were killed. And I think I never really responded to them very well, their stories, because I would have great sympathy and sorrow for not only what happened, but what I saw, the continuing tragedy in their lives, because the cases were never solved. They don't know, and they didn't know who killed their sons, who killed their daughters. And so I always felt so inadequate, as they were kind enough to speak to me to help me do news stories about their personal tragedy. And I never thought that I did a very good job of speaking with them. And usually when I encountered that situation, I was mostly quiet. I said as little as possible because I didn't know what to say.
Honestly, Dick, I don't know that there is a response in a situation like that that is going to help what people in that situation have been through.
Well, there's no response that I could ever give them, and I'm glad that you understand.
Yeah. You know, I think that a lot of people maybe don't understand how much of reporting work is unglamorous and involves shoe leather, boring public hearings, or, you know, stuff that just needs a bit of research and a bit of thought. And it's, you know, it's not celebrity interviews. It's trying to figure out what's going on with the Water Bureau or things of that nature. And yet there are moments in which the workday can be very dramatic. Was there ever a moment when you were maybe close to deadline, or it just seemed like everything was going wrong and you just didn't think you were going to finish the story, but you did?
Well, I think there were a lot of times where I didn't really finish the story, that's for sure. And I covered my share of fires, murders, and school board meetings. I've always thought that's the heart of what we do every day. And you try your best to figure out what's going on in those situations and figure what is the little shining angle that needs to come through and break through that I can help put on the air to illuminate for our listeners what's really going on. Fortunately, we have the beauty of the technology to allow us to do live radio, put things on live as they're happening, unfiltered to the public. And so I think I rarely felt that something that I was putting on was unfinished. If it was unfinished, it was because it was naturally unfinished. And we'd go back later and find out what the real story was and find out what the conclusion is. That's the beauty of live broadcasting and live radio. So I'm not so sure I worried so much about those kind of situations that you just mentioned.
Do you ever worry about the future of audio as a medium?
No. Very simply put, as long as people have two ears and they can hear, they will be interested and seek out what is on the radio, what is being offered to them in audio form. That's why people will always be interested in listening to Stateside, in listening to breaking news stories, newscasts. It's the easiest way for someone to learn what's happening quickly and what's happening now. All they have to do is push a button and then listen. There's no other effort that they need to exercise. On television, you have to watch the screen because it is picture-oriented. If you go away from the TV, then you lose what's happening. In a newspaper, you've got to read it, whether it's a hard copy in your hands or a screen in front of you. And you have to concentrate on what you're looking at. In radio, you just need to listen to it. That's the beauty of it. And so I think it's very easy to understand why radio and radio news has been around for 100 years. And I think it'll be around for at least another 100.
Dick Hafner has just retired from 30 years at WJR in Detroit. He put in a good 20 before that as well. Dick, it's amazing to talk to you. And we hope that you have a safe holiday season and get as much enjoyment out of it as you can.
Bye-bye, April. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. And that's our show for today. Producers on Stateside include Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Interns are Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. I'm April Baer. Thank you for showing up with us today. We'll see you tomorrow.